Hello and welcome to Economics in 10 with Pete and Gav. Today we're looking at fiscal policy, another Economics in 10 special to kind of coincide or to go link with a monetary policy special that we've only recently done. So hopefully these two can work together in tandem to give you a better knowledge about our economic situation today.
So we're discussing things in the October of 2022,
right,
in the UK, which is an interesting time, to say the least, for fiscal policy. But hopefully the things we'll talk about tonight will be timeless.
Yes, as all our podcasts are.
Of course.
Okay, so first question, Pete. What is fiscal policy?
Fiscal policy, very simply, is the use of taxation and government spending to achieve government aims. In the UK, at least, the plans for fiscal policy are normally laid out in an annual statement called the budget.
Yeah.
And there's a bit of razzmatazz about that. The Chancellor appears outside number 11 Downing Street with a red box. There's other sort of little traditions associated with the budget, like apparently they can choose what they want to drink in the Commons. Yeah.
Yeah.
What would you drink? Are you delivering your sort of budget special?
I'd go whiskey.
Would you? Yeah.
Yeah, I think a traditionalist. Well, no, it's not traditional.
Isn't it?
You find out later on, Pete.
Oh, okay. Well, there we are. So the timing of the budget in the financial year has been moved around a bit. It used to be in the spring.
Mm.
And then in the autumn, they'd lay out sort of what's called the autumn statement. But it's been... I can't remember where we're at the moment. There's been so many budgets recently, in part because when you get a new government in the UK or a new administration, you often get an emergency budget. And we've had loads of bloody new governments recently.
Yeah.
We've had various budgets or fiscal events.
Yes.
So, Gavin, what is the difference between a budget and a fiscal event?
Is it to do with the fact that one doesn't get overviewed by the OBR?
Yes, I think it is.
Maybe
so in the UK recently, recently demised then, he's not dead, but our recently sacked Chancellor of the Exchequer, Kwasi Kwarteng, he held a fiscal event. And the reason for that, rather than when our, oh God, she is still our Prime Minister, isn't she? Liz Truss came to power, rather than hold a budget, which would mean that there had to be some sort of external oversight by the Office for Budget Responsibility, it was called a fiscal event.
Yeah.
In large part, independent commentators would say, to avoid that kind of oversight. All very odd.
Now, normally, though, it was done in March, wasn't it? Because it was just before the change of the tax year, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So that was kind of a traditional one, wasn't it?
I think Philip Hammond changed it, didn't he?
Yeah, he brought it in and then bought this. But then what's quite interesting is, do you remember when Gordon Brown used to have the green budget? And it was around this time. So it was like November's the green budget. And there was this brilliant... They used to send out these great documents because it was like basically a consultation paper.
Right.
Green paper.
Yeah.
And then he'd do the budget after supposedly this kind of consultation.
Like trailing what's going
to
happen.
And I know I used to, like with my classes, get us to, we used to write because they wanted feedback. So we used to write to Gordon Brown and say, you know, and then he'd then obviously deliver it. Now, the best thing about the budget, Pete, is what, if you're a school teacher?
I don't know.
Playing budget bingo. Yeah. So, you know, many times have I got students in a classroom, we're all watching it, we all got our bingo sheets, and it was always brilliant with Osborne, because he'd have all these kind of like sayings, you know, let's fix the roof while the sun shines, and, you know, this kind of power up countries. And it, you know, he used to have these fantastic slogans.
Yeah.
But alas, kind of gone these days.
Yeah, well, there's been so much change, hasn't there?
Yeah.
Need some stability.
But anyway...
By the way, I should mention, because I'm not sure we're going to mention it again, but the Office for Budget Responsibility was brought in 2010 by the coalition government.
Mm.
And in some respects, it does mirror the sort of new Labour announcement in 1997, I think, about the independence of the Bank of England, because it's a way of sort of stating... we are serious about the economy and we're not just going to publish our own sort of forecast of what impact we think the budget will have. We've got an independent body who will do that for us. So you can see why When, oh, well, perhaps you can see why, when Kuateng sort of said, oh, no, we're going to call it a fiscal event and there won't be OBR oversight, a lot of people started getting a bit jittery, thinking, well, why not? Why wouldn't you have this independent oversight unless you felt that that independent oversight would reveal that your numbers didn't add up?
But I read the other day as well that the OBR can only go with what is kind of the assumptions put forward by the government. So the government actually come up with unrealistic assumptions, and yet the OBR still just have to run with it. That's basically their mandate. So it's kind of quite interesting, isn't it? What I was going to say, though, before, I assume we're going to move on.
Yeah,
but you said government spending and taxation there.
Yeah.
So a nice way of remembering it is G&T, isn't it?
Yeah, G&T.
Yeah, G&T. So classic kind of approach. And fiscal policy, G&T.
And actually, my wife, who is also an economics teacher, small world. Her students at the end of the summer term, because occasionally, and if any of our students are listening to this, do bear in this mind, this is a long-standing tradition. Students tend to buy their teachers alcoholic beverages. And her students quite wittily bought some gin and some tonic and labelled them government spending and taxation.
Perfect.
Yeah.
So, when it comes to fiscal policy, what are the big revenue raisers?
So, it has to be said, this differs from country to country, but I'm going to talk about the UK, and perhaps we can also mention a couple of other countries as well. Yeah. But in the UK, the biggest contributors to public finances are, unsurprisingly, or maybe it isn't unsurprising, income tax. So in 2021-22, that was anticipated to raise about 198 billion, according to Treasury's own figures. National insurance, which a good chunk of which is really income tax again. Yeah, that's 147 billion. And then the third biggest is VAT, value-added tax, which is a sales tax, if you like, on the majority of purchases one might make. So there are other sort of contributors, excise duty, so like petrol duty, alcohol duty, cigarette duty. Corporation tax, so tax on firm profits, is relatively small, only 40 billion. Yeah, I'm not saying that's insignificant, but relatively small, So that's the UK. Does any of that surprise you?
Not really.
No.
Can I just say, though, we should point out probably, I hope you don't mind explaining this, Pete, the difference between, like, when we think about taxation, the difference between progressive and regressive.
Yeah, I thought we were going to come on to that later.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah. Okay.
I haven't got that down as later. But, I mean, because the thing is that I think it's kind of important to kind of maybe appreciate that probably over the last, 20-odd years, we've definitely moved from a kind of a more progressive to a more regressive system.
Okay, I don't mind mentioning that then.
Go on,
so, a progressive tax is a bit like, I always explain, a bit like Robin Hood. Taking from the rich to give to the poor. And regressive, if you like, is the opposite of that. So something like income tax, which has sort of higher taxes for higher income brackets. So in the UK, in effect, for income tax, there's three main sort of tax thresholds. So you get a certain amount of income tax free, about £13,000. Then between, I think it's approximately £13,000 and maybe about £45,000-£50,000, something like that, is 20p in the pound. And above that is 40p in the pound. And then there's a high income threshold of 150 grand. And any income above that, you pay sort of 45 pence.
And it's all on the margin, isn't it?
It's all on the margin. It's worth saying that, because it's like you do get the odd sort of person sort of talking head. Remember someone getting really irate on Question Time, which is a political show in the UK. I pay this much on my earnings. And it's not true. I mean, if you do pay, if you are earning enough, if you're fortunate enough to earn enough to pay the sort of higher tax rate of 45p, it's only on the earnings above 150,000.
I remember Alan Sugar saying it once about basically having half his income taxed. But I would assume actually at the real top end, it probably is quite true, isn't it, I suppose?
Yeah, it may well be.
So anyway.
It may well be. So a regressive tax is a tax which falls disproportionately on the poor. And an example of that would be cigarette duties. Poor are more likely to smoke and it will form quite a large part of their income. But VAT is regressive as well. So as you rightly pointed out, there's probably been a shift in the UK away from sort of more progressive measures towards more regressive measures. And that's reflected in the fact that, linking back to our last episode, the Gini coefficient for the UK, the sort of measure of inequality, the UK has become more unequal in the last sort of 20 to 30 years. I did look at just one or two other economies to look at sort of sources of income. That does vary from country to country. I was looking at the Chinese economy, which is probably slightly more opaque, but there was some sort of Bloomberg data about this based on Ministry of Finance data. And actually, for the funding sources for Chinese sort of budgetary spending, only 47% of it is from taxation.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so all the sources include sort of government funds, special sort of government non-tax fees. You know, it seems more complex.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, and I suppose for some countries as well, they will have a sovereign wealth fund.
Right.
So somewhere like Norway.
Norway has that.
Yeah. Will have a sort of significant contribution from that sort of sovereign wealth fund. I was actually looking as well. Really good. Infographic in which it shows the sort of proportions of taxation raised in various countries from different sources. So if you look at America, for example, individual taxes accounts for about 42% of American sort of budgetary spending. Consumption taxes, or sales taxes if you like, is about 18%. In the UK, that does differ. You know, income tax or individual tax is only like 33%. Does that surprise you?
Yeah, it probably does a bit, I think.
Yeah. But yeah, it varies more than I thought, actually. You know, Japan is probably social insurance, which I presume is their equivalent of national insurance, is about 40% of income. And individual tax is relatively small.
We'll tweet that out there. Where do you get that from?
Yeah. Oh, do you know what? I think it's... I made a note of it later on. I'll come to it. There's some really good infographics, which I'll come to later on. So we've explained progressive and regressive. We should say proportional as well. That's sort of another way of... There was a few years ago, people talking about flat taxes.
Yeah.
And that's the idea that everyone gets the same tax on all of their income.
Yeah.
There was a case for that in that if you've got a country where... lots of individuals are operating in the informal economy, what used to be called black markets, you could argue that to have a simple tax code might draw more people back into the formal economy. And if you went for it might be better to have a low flat rate of tax if that means more people are prepared to operate legally. You'll get more tax that way than if you have you basically squeezed a few people who do pay tax.
You know what I think you're talking about there?
What am I talking about?
Trustonomics. No, honestly, I think that's the long-term aim for me. I mean, you think about Quasi and Truss were kind of brought up in the incubator of the IEA and those kind of think tanks.
Yeah.
And they a few years back, they did a massive push on flat taxes, having basically a 20% flat tax. I think they were basically arguing as well, you raise the threshold up a little bit more, but then you have a flat tax, there's 20%, and that was it.
Yeah.
And you could see it with the collapsing of the 45% rate to 40%.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not a big leap to say, right, let's collapse it all again, mm-hmm. or have 25% for everyone at every level. Mm-hmm. So it's a kind of an interesting one to think about really there, though. But proportional taxation. Thank you very much, Pete. So we know the big revenue raisers.
Yeah.
Okay. What do most countries spend their money on?
Well, in the UK, far and away, the largest area of public sector spending is social protection. It's interesting within that, so social protection will include sort of all benefits, including sort of pensions. And I remember I always do this as an exercise at the start of the year, whereby I ask sort of kids, like, oh, look at this massive sum of money the government spends on social protection. What proportion of it do you think is unemployment benefit?
Yeah.
And they're always like, oh, 80%?
Yeah.
60%? And actually... it's about 2%.
Yeah.
It's tiny, you know, compared with the sort of huge sums of money, which has an aging population, we spend on pensions.
No, and that's always one of the fascinating things, isn't it? Because it's like, right, we're going to cut benefits. And then you go, right, okay, well, how are you going to do that to save lots of money? You can't do it by targeting unemployment benefits.
No, you can't.
The only way you can really save money is to actually hammer pensions, and they're never going to do it if they're your core vote.
Yeah, and actually, the Conservative Party in the UK has committed over a relatively long period now to something called the triple lock,
yeah.
which means that pensions will always rise in line with, I think it's average earnings, inflation,
yeah.
or I can't remember what the third one is.
Real pay.
So yeah. whichever is highest.
Yeah.
So basically, without being too cynical, I think the reason for that is simply that the elderly tend to vote, and probably disproportionately they vote Conservative.
Yeah.
But if you look at the others, the second largest area of public spending in the UK, health at £230 billion, probably a lot of that is looking after the elderly yeah. as well. So in a sense, if we are in sort of a budgetary squeeze and have been for sort of some time now, it's partly due to a sort of lack of willingness to address the sort of demographic
yeah.
change in the UK.
Yeah.
The fact that when pensions were brought in, or, you know, sort of a universal sort of pension was brought in, people just didn't live that long. And it's an enormous success story that people now live to a much greater age in the UK. But there hasn't really, I mean, there's been some sort of changes to reflect that, like an increase in the retirement age. But it's only recently people have been sort of having to sort of made to contribute to their own pensions, or, you know. So it's a big problem.
Yeah. The third biggest one is education.
Yeah, yeah. Paying our wages.
Yeah. yeah.
Money well spent, obviously.
And what's quite interesting about that, I mean, that was in the news today, they reckon there was some head teacher basically saying that 90% of schools will be bust, wasn't it?
well, there's a couple of reasons for that. One is the energy prices, which schools are having to face, which yeah. are huge. But secondly, the government is very likely to agree to higher pay increases for teachers than schools will have budgeted for. But they're going to be told to make those pay increases out of current funds.
Yeah, it's incredible.
Which is incredible, because probably about 80% of a secondary school certainly's budget
Will be salary. Yeah.
Well, it is salaries.
Yeah.
So if you add on sort of 5-10, you know, anything above 5%, and that's a huge sum of money, but there's no additional funding coming from central government. Yeah. So something we'll have to give there. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out
yeah.
as the year goes on.
Another one I always find fascinating, when I do this kind of wagon wheel in the class, I'm sure other people do as well, you know, like guess the top five.
Hmm.
And no one obviously ever gets that their interest is yeah, basically yeah. the fourth highest one, isn't it? Or something like that. Or is it fifth highest?
It's high. I mean, it's £45 billion. So I think... that would be,
I
yeah,
think it is. I think it's the fourth highest, I'm yeah. sure it is. And next is like defence, I think.
Defence is about £60 billion.
Oh, is it? Okay, so yeah. it's the fifth highest.
It's a bit less than transport.
Yeah. Oh, is it? No, normally. Oh, okay.
Well, I'm only looking at the 2021-22 figures.
Okay.
So that's £51 yeah. billion for transport.
Well, I know normally it's definitely billion in the top for five interest, debt interest. And it's, but what it does, it kind of highlights sort of like the opportunity cost of like borrowing money, because you're then thinking, look, this is how much we have to pay yeah. back.
And of course, and so, that's been worsened by the recent debacle.
Yeah.
Because I think the sort of fiscal event has led to a seemingly semi-permanent increase at the rate at which the government can borrow money.
Yeah. Yeah.
So even a couple of years ago, the government in the UK was able to borrow money at a really low rate of interest at about...
Yeah.
2%, and I'm probably jumping ahead here slightly, but that's risen quite significantly now to about 4.5%, yeah. something like that. I mean, it does change on a
yeah.
sort of fairly daily basis, but
that was one of the big criticisms, wasn't it? I think of like Osborne's austerity, that at a time when he was kind of really hauling back, that was like the best time to kind of borrow to invest.
Although you could argue the reason why the interest rate remained low was because the financial markets,
yeah.
in effect,
like just prudence.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, there's two ways of looking at that.
It's a fair point. It's a yeah. fair point to make.
I mean, just again, to look at other countries in America, Social Security is still, it's not dissimilar, actually. Social Security is 19% of discretionary and mandatory sort of spending in the US.
Yeah, I saw that Medicare. I got Medicare is really high.
Yeah, it's the second yeah. highest, 15%. Well, health.
Yeah. Oh, no, I've got a different thing where I've got...
Oh, no, sorry, yeah, you've got healthcare and Medicare. Medicare
16%, yeah. And then health 13%. Yeah. And then, but the big one, big difference for America is always their national defence spending, which is always utterly...
Yeah, there's some sort of fairly... It depends. I've seen on some sort of sources that when you're looking at the proportions of spending, sometimes they make this distinction between discretionary and mandatory.
Right, okay.
And so if you looked just at discretionary spending, like almost defence spending is about like 57%, but it's slightly misleading because actually when you look at the federal budget overall, including sort of mandatory and discretionary defence is... It's a huge sum of money, but it's not quite as big a proportion of the overall federal budget. I suppose the American sort of tax system is complicated because so much of it is devolved to the states.
Yeah.
The individual states will have a lot more power to both raise taxes and, you know, vary how they spend money.
Yeah.
Which is, there isn't really a parallel in the UK.
Yeah.
We've got a very centralised government.
Yeah, because I looked up the French one. I was trying to work out what they do, and it seemed a lot of it was regional kind of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're unusually sort of centralised. I mean, again, in Germany, I think there's a lot of power devolved to the different regions, or Länder, as they're called.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah.
Right, are we done there with
that? Yeah, let's move
on. Okay, excellent. Okay, what do we mean by budget deficit, budget surplus, and a balanced budget?
Okay, so a budget deficit is about the plans or the spending by a government in 1 year. So if government spending is greater than taxation in sort of one financial year, then that would be a budget deficit. If, on the other hand, taxation was greater than government spending in that financial year, then you would say the government was running a surplus, right, which it does extremely rarely. A balanced budget would be where government spending is equal to taxation. And for some, you know, some would sort of make the analogy, and I think we did mention this before we went on air, between the household budget and the government budget. You know, like, oh, you should always sort of balance your books, as it were. And I think in California, I think when Schwarzenegger was governor, there was sort of this idea that a balanced budget amendment was going to be signed into law. Maybe I'm making it up. But I think some of those sort of comparisons between household budgets and governments are false. You know, I don't think you can quite extend that. And also probably households, if you like, run into deficits. You might borrow a bit more money at some points, then at other points you would pay that back. Yeah. So the idea that a government budget should always balance, I'm not even sure that is true of household budgets.
Yeah,
you know,
that's a fair point.
You might borrow money to buy a car and then pay it back over time.
Yeah.
So in a sense, why shouldn't governments do that? But I don't want to sort of get into that too much. But I think as well, we sometimes call, when government spending is greater than taxation, we call that an expansionary budget.
Yes.
And the idea there is that will ultimately increase demand in the economy, what we call in economics aggregate demand.
Right.
Because government spending is quite a significant proportion of overall demand in the economy. Probably about sort of between 20 and 25% in the UK. And then a contractionary budget would be where taxation was greater than government spending. So that in effect would be removing sort of funds from the, what we call in economics, a circular flow of income. And that would have the effect of contracting aggregate demand. And you might do that, for example, if you're in a period of high inflation. You might want to increase taxes to stop that demand pull inflation sort of rising too rapidly.
Right.
And another bit of lingo with respect to that, did you want me to talk about discretionary versus automatic stabilisers?
Yeah, go on then.
Yeah?
Because I think that's a good thing to know, isn't it, automatic stabilisers?
Yeah, so let's imagine you've got the economic cycle, and generally economies are cyclical. They're not sort of cyclical in some smooth way, like every 10 years we boom, every 10 years we go into recession, but they do tend to rise and fall. And so governments in the past certainly have, and even today, have used either fiscal or probably more commonly these days, monetary policy to try and sort of ameliorate the sort of the more extreme aspects of that cycle.
Yeah.
So if the economy is booming too rapidly and there's concerns about inflation, then you would aim for some form of contractionary policy. If the economy is going into recession or is already sort of going sort of on a downward turn, you would then sort of aim to be expansionary in either your sort of monetary or fiscal policy. Now, a discretionary fiscal policy would be where the government actually changes either government spending or taxation, like the rate. Right. So, for example, if you're in a recession, let's say the basic rate of taxation was 20%, and you thought, well, we're in a recession, we need to boost consumption. If you cut the marginal rate to sort of 19 or 18%, that would be a discretionary fiscal policy.
Expansionary.
Yeah? An expansionary, yeah, discretionary right. fiscal policy.
Okay.
And similarly, if you're entering into a boom, you could think, well, let's move that 20p up to 22p.
Yeah.
You know, try to sort of pull out some of the spending which may be causing inflation in the economy. Automatic stabilizers is just an effect of having in place two things. Firstly, a benefit system. So let's say you do go into a recession. If automatically people have an entitlement to benefits, it will mean that the worst of a recession may be lessened somewhat in that people's incomes don't drop to zero, they drop down to whatever the benefit yeah. level is. And that means some consumption still takes place, and it means the you know, the economy doesn't bottom out as much as it might if you didn't have that benefit system in place. And similarly, most countries have a progressive taxation system. And so let's say you've got these different thresholds at which you pay higher rates of tax. So let's say you're a relatively low income earner, you're earning sort of 12 grand a year, but that moves up to 15,000. Well, you would then go into, you'd go above the personal allowance and into the area where you pay some tax. So that in effect would siphon off a little bit of income. Or people might move into the 40p sort of rate by sort of earning extra salaries, yeah. but then they're taxed a little bit more. So some of those, that extra income, which might arise during a boom, is siphoned off as people head upwards into higher tax thresholds.
Yeah.
And that has a stabilizing effect on the economy and perhaps lessens the more severe impacts of that could occur in an inflationary sort of boom.
And that, and those things, going back to, say, a deficit situation
mm-hmm.
where you're in a bust and then yeah. obviously the automatic stabilizers kick in.
Yeah.
Yeah, so suddenly, like, we're paying out more benefits. Normally, as a government, or economists probably, wouldn't really worry about that deficit. They kind of call it a cyclical deficit.
Yeah, they would, yeah.
And then say, right, let's not, you know, as long as we know that that's part yeah. of the business cycle, it's fine.
Yeah.
What a lot of economists get worried about when they talk about budget deficit is what is known as a structural deficit, yeah. isn't it?
And basically, you're absolutely right, Gav. Sort of during a recession, it would be expected that you know, the government's finances would worse. For one, you'd be paying out more in sort of unemployment benefit. And for two, in a recession, people's incomes tend to fall. And therefore, income tax receipts will fall. People will probably spend less money. So any, you know, VAT receipts, excise duties, all these things would fall. So your tax revenues would fall and your spending would rise. You could be paying more in benefits. So that is likely to happen. What many economists would like to see is that during the boom phase,
yeah.
almost that the funds which you might have lost, or, you know, the deficit you might have run up during that recessionary period, are offset by sort of extra income accruing to the government during a boom phase. But it very rarely happens.
No. That was the old thing about Osborne's fixing the roof when the sun shone, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So you
yeah.
basically patch up your finances when it's boom time. And in many respects, Brown had that, didn't he? He had this kind of golden cycle or something
did,
like that.
No, he had two golden rules. And one was that the government should really only borrow to invest.
Yeah.
And secondly, that... well, absolutely that. You shouldn't run structural deficits.
Yeah, because it was over the cycle.
Over the cycle, out, yeah. Things should even yeah. out. And that didn't happen.
Yeah, but to be fair to Gordon, because he had those two surplus years at the beginning, didn't he? He was kind of quite close, and then obviously the financial crash ruined him. Because his argument was that literally when that happened, he was going to then start kind of pulling it back so that it would have evened out across the time. But
possibly.
Obviously, it didn't really happen. Yeah. Okay, well, that's quite a lot there.
Yeah.
I hope everyone's getting these kind of terms. I know sometimes it can be quite difficult.
Yeah.
That's why John Lanchester's book is really good, called Whoops.
Right.
Yeah, because he talks about the kind of hidden language of economics. And I think some of this stuff tonight is exactly what we're talking about. Contractionary, expansionary, yeah. and automatic stabilizers.
Yeah,
and,
there's a lot of lingo. Yeah, there and to be honest, yeah. most of it is not that difficult.
No, but I suppose it's the fact that...
What I mean is the actual concepts, yes. once they're explained in simple terms,
yeah.
are not that challenging. It's no. just that there is a lot of jargon.
That's true. Okay, how does the budget deficit slash surplus link to the national debt? This is a kind of a classic question that gets A-level students a lot, don't it?
Yes, and you've probably noted that when I talked about budgets earlier, I said in one year. So basically, the government in one year could run a budget deficit. So let's say its government spending was planned to be greater than taxation. Well, obviously, there's a shortfall there, so the government will have to borrow the money. And the way the government borrows money is typically by the issuance of government bonds, which in the UK, nicknamed gilts. Gilts. You know what they're nicknamed? Gilts.
I read about it the other day. I can't remember.
They've got a little gold edge to the actual certificates you get.
Yeah.
And every time the government borrows money, that adds to the existing debts of the government, which is called the national debt. Now, some of that debt may be from like 50, 60 years ago in some cases, but it's not yet fully been paid off. So every time in one year we run a deficit, then that adds to the overall national debt. So just to summarise, a budget deficit is the difference between taxation and spending in one year. And the national debt is an accumulation of all those deficits, plus any unpaid interest, and minus any efforts to pay off the debt, which the government could do on occasion by running a budget surplus. Now, do you want me to give you a brief potted history of the national debt?
Yeah, go on then, go for it. Yeah. Can I just say, you can go on, before you do that, on this site called the National Debt Clock.
Mm.
And it's quite frightening what you see. Just see this number is ticking along. And UK national debt grows at a rate of £5,170 per second.
Yeah.
Okay, debt per citizen is £44,106. Debt per taxpayer, $75,862.
Yeah, and all of
sounds
that...
Sounds all quite scary, doesn't it?
It does all sound quite scary, but again, I think it's partly from that mistaken desire. And I think some of it dates back to Thatcher. You know, Thatcher would sort of talk about, you know, the government as if it was like a household. And I get it to a degree. You know, you don't want to go crazy, and there is a role for sort of prudence. But the government is qualitatively different than a household in terms of how it borrows. And I'm sure there'd be some people who'd disagree with me there.
Yeah.
But anyway, just to go back to the history of the national debt, when in history was the national debt at its all-time peak? And when I say at its all-time peak, we tend to compare the national debt to the size of GDP.
Yes.
So when we saw... And again, I think some people misunderstand this, but they might say, oh, you know, the national debt is 80% of GDP. It's not that 80% of, you know, the value of GDP is being used in that year to pay off. It's just comparing. It's like you've got one number here, GDP, which we might vaguely understand. And then national debt is another number. And people like to sort of compare the two, if you like. So there's some kind of benchmark. So at the moment, I think the national debt in the UK is about 106% of GDP, something like that.
Yeah.
But it has been much higher. To be fair, though, nearly invariably that's during sort of wartime periods. So the Napoleonic War and the sort of period just after led to the national debt rising to about over 250% of GDP. And then subsequent peaks were around World War One, where it rose to about 170% of GDP. Then World War II, again, closing on sort of 250% of GDP. So then after World War II, it tends to sort of decline fairly steadily until we get down into sort of the 30s% of GDP. And it's only with the financial crisis in 2008 and the huge sums of money sort of spent on bank bailouts that we then tend to rise very rapidly to what, and really we've stayed at about that figure now, somewhere between sort of 90 and 105, 110% of GDP. And we've also had the sort of coronavirus pandemic, yeah, which was a huge, you know, the furlough scheme was very, very expensive. And so the national debt as a proportion of GDP has risen, you know, fairly, very rapidly, in fact, in the last 15 years, but still well below, one could argue, some of the previous peaks.
Yeah.
Albeit those are sort of during wars, which if you think about the impacts of a war, one, you've got to spend loads of money on the war effort, but lots of things, you know, normal activity will be suspended, GDP, you know, trade sinks, will be suspended, you know, and so on.
On a side note, though, Pete, can I just say, this is just a bit of a historical thing, you know, those numbers have in the past sort of mattered. So, for example, if the UK wanted to join the Eurozone, they put in some rules, didn't they? It was like, oh, every country had to be 60% GDP.
I thought it was 40% debt rate.
I think, whatever. It was 3% for the actual budget deficit.
Yeah, was it the fiscal stability framework?
Yeah, so there was this kind of thing. And so if you had over 60% GDP ratio or whatever, or maybe 40%, well, I'm sure, anyway, and then 3% yearly, but then you wouldn't have been able to join. So it's kind of, they're trying to get this convergence criteria, wasn't it?
Yeah.
To try and get everyone in sync. And then what was funny about it is that they basically all cheated anyway, didn't they, with their sums, didn't they?
Well, I think
that's what eventually came
out. I think firstly, like, I think the Germans particularly were quite sniffy about the fact that some of the sort of Mediterranean countries like Portugal and Spain were breaking this. But then I think they broke it.
Yeah, exactly.
France broke it and then thought, oh, we better keep quiet about that.
But
the reason for that ultimately, though, was that and this will become more relevant later on, fiscal policy didn't undermine monetary policy. Yeah. Because in a sense, if you're committing to a common sort of monetary framework, which, you know, the Eurozone countries now do entirely, but even the precursor, the ERM, if you can't really... Because in a sense, once you go into the Eurozone, you're committing to a common currency, but also a common interest rate. It has to be a common interest rate. And you can't really have a situation, because if you're setting an interest rate for the whole of the Eurozone, that's a huge sort of range of territory, but also countries perhaps at different stages in their economic cycle.
You need fiscal discipline.
Yeah, but if you don't have fiscal discipline, the idea is you then might unleash inflation in one country.
Yeah.
The sort of central Eurozone interest rate may need to rise, even though that might be to the detriment of other countries who have been more disciplined in their fiscal policy. So you can sort of see the logic of it.
Yeah.
Anyway, who in the world has the highest debt to GDP ratio?
Well, I'm going to guess Japan.
It is Japan.
Yeah.
Do you know what it is?
No.
Well, according to these figures, 257%.
Wow.
And I think, do you know why? Why that's so high?
Because I assume they've just tried to spend and spend and spend to try and get out of their depression.
Yeah, I think, they had that sort of lost decade where they sort of were in a sort of deflationary spiral.
Yeah.
And I think there was huge sums of government spending aimed at sort of... getting the
it's amazing, isn't it? Really. Yeah, what's the lowest? Do we know the lowest?
Well, there's some on the periphery. I mean, it's interesting though, because a different range of countries on the sort of periphery. It's a really good infographic that we must share. But they're almost there for different reasons. Some of those are sort of European countries like Luxembourg and Sweden, who you can imagine, you know, manage their sort of finances very well, and they're quite wealthy countries. But then you also get countries like Chad, and their indebtedness is probably because they're just not able to borrow on international markets. Okay. So there's sort of people are on this periphery probably for different reasons.
Yeah.
I suppose, you know, again, I mean, there's obviously concerns about the UK's debt, but Italy has a much higher sort of debt to GDP ratio. Spain's is higher. Canada's is higher, which surprised me. France's is higher.
Yeah.
You know, so it's, in a sense, it sort of reiterates, though, or reinforces what we were saying earlier about how, you know, cretinous the sort of recent fiscal event was. Because in a sense, the government has been able to portray itself as being sort of disciplined with its finances. And I think that reputation, to a certain extent, has now gone, because even with the reversal of a lot of the policies which were outlined in that fiscal measure, the interest rate at which people are prepared to lend to the UK government has not yet, I mean, I suppose you could argue it's early days, but it's not yet gone down to sort of previous levels.
It's just a matter of time.
Well, I think that that reputation for sort of fiscal prudence is quite hard won, though.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, there we are. Do you know what the US is?
No.
133% of GDP.
Mm, well, there you go.
But again, you could argue, in some respects, so what? I think that's what Keynes and Keynesians would argue. As long as you can pay it back.
Exactly.
You know, who cares?
Exactly.
You know?
Pay your debts.
Yeah, as long as you can keep up your debts. And it's a bit like, you know, if you borrow money, and everyone, if you can extend the household analogy here. Loads of households borrow money. They borrow huge sums of money relative to their income, in the UK particularly, to buy a house. And everyone thinks, well, it's fine as long as you can keep up with the debt repayments.
Exactly.
Who cares, you know?
Exactly.
So you could almost make, you know, as long as people are prepared to buy your debt, as it were, you know, then, you know, does it matter?
Exactly. I think that's a fair point. It's a fair point to make. Right. Is that the end for that one?
Yeah.
Okay. Now it's halfway through, Pete.
Yeah.
I think it's time for a quiz.
Oh, looking forward to it.
Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. This is the red box quiz.
Okay.
So as you've quite rightly pointed out, every year, the Chancellor of the Exchequer will hold up a red box to signify the new budget for the UK economy.
Yeah.
So here we go. Quiz all about this. Question one. The red box of William Gladstone was made for his first budget in 1853 and was used by many subsequent chancellors. Who was the last chancellor to use it? Was it Gordon Brown, George Osborne, Alistair Darling, or Philip Hammond?
Oh, you know, I was hoping you would say something much earlier. I am going to say Gordon Brown.
No.
Right, okay.
It was George Osborne. Oh. I think in 2010 or 2011.
Well, that box has lasted a good
while. Yeah, he retired it. Gordon Brown had his own one made, I think. I think Philip Hammond did as well, actually.
That sounds a bit of a cheat question.
Or something like that. But George, no, because then it came back. It was just there. But you got that wrong.
Yeah,
you did. You did.
Okay, all right.
Who famously opened up his red box in 1868 to discover he had left his speech at home? Was it William Gladstone, George Red Hunt, or Benjamin Disraeli?
I don't think Disraeli was Chancellor. I'm going to say Gladstone.
I thought you just choose George Red Hunt. Because this is obvious, isn't it?
George Red Hunt.
Yeah, that was his name.
I've never heard of him.
No, exactly. That's why I assumed, because I've never heard of him either.
Yeah.
So it was him.
Okay. Not doing well so far.
But you know what, though? It's interesting you said that about Disraeli. Because I looked
up. He was Chancellor.
Though. He was a Chancellor.
I don't think Disraeli was.
Yeah, that's the thing. Because when I looked up, I was thinking, who's this George Red Hunt dude? So I then looked up the list of Chancellors. And there was George Red Hunt nestled in between Gladstone and Disraeli.
Do you know what? I didn't know that. I thought Disraeli, well, my own ignorance of the 19th century. Yeah.
The custom of using a red box supposedly came from Queen Elizabeth I's representative, Francis Throckmorton, presenting the Spanish ambassador, Bernardino de Mendoza, a red box in the late 16th century.
Yeah.
But what was inside the box? Was it black pudding, carrots, steak and kidney pies?
Do you know what? Black pudding is liked in Spain. Quite much here. What are the options again?
Black puddings, carrots, or steak and kidney pies?
I'll say black puddings.
It is black pudding!
Yes!
Okay. Yes. That made me laugh when I found that out. Yeah. So I thought,
do you like black pudding?
I love black pudding.
Yeah, me too.
What is the summer residence of the UK Chancellor?
Is it Chevening?
Oh, I haven't got there yet.
No, go on then.
Is it Chequers,
no.
Chevening, or Thorny Wood?
I think it's Chevening.
Thorny Wood.
What is it? Is Chevening the Foreign Secretary?
Yeah.
I knew that.
I think it's the Forest Executive Chairman. It's definitely not. It's Donnywood. Traditionally, this is why I got you to...
See, no one goes there these days because no one's there long enough to be Chancellor. No. It's not really in the news.
I quite like the fact Donnywood, isn't it? It's not Hollywood
for chancellors. It rings a bell now.
Nice name. This is why I got a pen and pencil for you, Pete.
Okay, yeah.
This is very rare, everyone. Yeah, but I thought Pete might have to take notes for this one.
Go on.
Now, you said about how the Chancellor traditionally has been able to drink whatever they wanted at the dispatch box.
Yes.
Can you match the former Chancellor to the drink?
Right, go on.
Right, so who are the
Chancellors?
Kenneth Clark.
Yeah.
Geoffrey Howe.
Yeah.
John Major.
Yeah.
William Gladstone.
Yeah.
Nigel Lawson.
Oh God, how many are there?
And George Osborne.
Yeah. All right, go on.
Do you want drinks?
Give me the drinks.
Gin and tonic. Spritzer.
Hang on, slow down.
Yeah, gin and tonic.
Yeah.
Spritzer. Brandy and water.
Yeah.
Whiskey. Sherry and a beaten egg. And water.
Read them again.
Gin and tonic, spritzer, brandy and water, whiskey, sherry and a beaten egg, and water. Do you want to start with the easy one? Do you think there is an easy one there?
No.
I think there's an easy one there.
Right. Go on. Sorry, you'll have to read them one more time. For
gin, gin and tonic, spritzer, brandy and water, whiskey, sherry and a beaten egg, water. I hope listeners are trying to work this out.
All right, Kenneth Clark, brandy.
There we go.
No.
Oh, do you? Well, no, you got. Because I mean, no, because you'll end up working it out through.
I don't think I've got any of them right, but I'll try. All right, Kenneth Clark. A jazz man, isn't he? What is he like?
I thought you'd get Kenneth Clark. I thought you'd only get two, basically.
Alright, Kenneth Clark, brandy. I think it's right.
Brandy and water.
Yeah.
Alright.
How? Spritzer.
Alright.
Major, water. Gladstone, the sherry and whatever it is.
Yeah, sherry and the beaten egg. Yeah.
Lawson, gin and tonic. Osborne. Oh, I don't know. I don't know what I've got left.
I don't know what you had. Whiskey. You had whiskey for it. No. You got one right.
Is it the Gladstone one?
Yeah.
Right, what were the others?
Well, to me, I thought you'd get Kenneth Clark. Because he was always drinking whiskey.
Brandy.
No, no, it was whiskey. He was whiskey.
Yeah.
Geoffrey Howe was a gin and tonic man.
Yeah.
John Major was brandy and water.
I can't imagine him having a drink.
Gladstone was sherry and a beaten egg. Yeah. Lawson, Nigel Lawson was the spritzer. And George Osborne was water.
That's what I wrote.
Why didn't you say it?
I don't know.
Yeah, well, okay. I'll give you two.
Yeah.
Because the thing about it is...
I got confused.
The last four chances, they've all drunk water.
Mm.
And so Osborne's like, it was the beginning of it. The beginning of the end. It's that tradition, though, isn't it? You know, you want them staggering in, don't you, with a bit of alcohol. So, basically, you could get 10 points there, Pete.
And I got...
And you got...
Four. I'm having them. Come on.
Three.
Three?
What? Look, you got black puddings.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you missed out on Donnywood, George Redhunt, George Osborne.
Yeah.
And you got two on that quiz.
Yeah, all right. So I'm really there. I'm three in total.
Yeah. I'm sure our listeners will.
I'm sure they would. I'm sure they'll exceed my score.
Okay, let's get back into the questions. Why does the UK, and I assume most other countries, historically have a deficit? And what's that got to do with James Buchanan and his public choice theory?
Well, it's obviously not everyone runs a deficit, country-wise. But I suppose... in some respects, it's a very simple answer. It's very difficult to raise taxes because no one likes them.
Yeah.
It's politically unpopular. And it's also very difficult to rein in spending. And that's where the sort of, Buchanan might come in. If you remember from our Buchanan episode, the idea of public choice theory, that, in a sense, politicians are just like anyone else. If you place them in a particular situation, they'll try and maximise their welfare. And welfare in that sense might be having a big department, you know, having a department which spends lots of money, you know, having, you know, a country residence.
Well, the biggest self-interest for them is to get re-elected.
Yeah. 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 And so they will be very, very loath to rein in spending, even if it might be the right thing to do in the sort of national interest and so on. By the way, here's a question for you. Since 1955, so that's 67 years, in how many years has the government run a budget surplus?
I'm going to go with 7.
Have you looked before?
No. But I just know this information because I know you kind of got the kind of brown... Because what's always interesting about it as well is that Labour have had more surpluses than Conservatives, haven't they?
Well,
I think so. Or maybe 4.
Okay, so let's
Labour
go
Brown are like 2 of those years, aren't
so they? So 69, 70. Sorry, no, there's a surplus in 55, 56. That will be the Conservatives.
Right.
Then 69 and 70, that will be Wilson's Labour. So that's 2-1. And then 87, 88, I think that's Lawson. That's 2-2. And then there's 2 years, 99. Maybe 3 years of surplus,
yeah,
actually.
Yeah,
there.
Brown,
there. Yeah, so there are more from Labour.
Yeah.
And in some respects, there's sort of, you know, the Labour sort of reputation for running up larger deficits. Look at throughout the kind of the 80s, I suppose the rate of increase was declining, but certainly throughout the Thatcher years, the government was running.
Yeah, but what was interesting about the Blair and Brown years, what the reason why they've got that surplus is because they agreed to stick to the Conservative spending plans to prove their fiscal kind of in discipline. So, I mean, it's sort of a little kind of cheat. I mean, fair play to them for doing it, but I mean, it is interesting that they did it having committed to the Conservative.
Yeah.
It was like a kind of a, I think, kind of like a Conservative kind of catch, isn't it? Or,
yeah, I'm not, I mean, I'm not sure, but I believe as well that one of the reasons why the Conservatives' deficits weren't even higher in the 1980s was because of the privatisation programme. Because obviously those are one-off. That's a one-off income. You can't sell the family silver twice.
Yeah, that's what Macmillan said.
Pardon?
Macmillan, wasn't he? Selling off the family silver.
But then that would have allowed them to either, well, not run surpluses, but their deficits would have been even higher without the income from those sort of
sell-offs. Well, and selling all those houses as well.
Yeah.
So, but there you go. Yeah, anyway, so we always have, well, not always, a lot of people have deficits, and you can put it down to Buchanan's public choice theory. Yeah. Who wants to rein in spending and increase taxes when you want to get elected?
Yeah.
No one. How effective is fiscal policy, and what can Ricardo and Phillips teach us about this?
Okay, so in some respects, if you're going to say how effective is fiscal policy, you need to sort of say, well, what is its objective?
Right.
if its objective is to sort of... perhaps sort of pump prime the economy, sort of reflate the economy, as it were, then Ricardo, if you come across the concept of Ricardian equivalence...
Well, I think we mentioned it briefly, didn't we, in the Ricardo podcast.
So this is where, this is the idea that any increase in government expenditure that increases the budget deficit leads to a corresponding decrease in consumption. And the reason for that is households save more because they think their taxes are going to rise in the future.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which...
It's a good evaluative point to make an essay, isn't it?
I think it might be an example of Ricardian vice.
Nice.
There's a logic to it.
Yeah.
But is it actually borne out by empirical reality? In all likelihood, not. Rather than Phillips, by the way, I know you said, you know, what can Phillips tell us about the effectiveness of fiscal policy? I did want to bring in a bit of Keynesian thinking here. I don't know if Phillips is associated with sort of Keynesian, but... And I wanted to bring in a concept which I think a lot of people are familiar with, and that is the multiplier.
Right. Yeah.
And certainly, Keynesians would argue that running a fiscal deficit is essential... if you're in a time of significant economic downturn. You need expansionary fiscal policy at that point. And in a sense, not only do you get the initial injection of government spending and reduction in taxation, that will reflate the economy to a degree, but you'll also get a disproportionate impact due to what's called the multiplier.
Yeah.
So in some respects, one person's spending becomes another person's income. So there's a kind of ripple effect from any injection of government spending. Let's say the government builds a new hospital. So obviously that might be, you know, 50 million worth of spending or something like that. Well, all the people who built that hospital will now have an income. They might spend it in local restaurants and cafes and so on. So there'll be that knock-on effect. And then the people in the cafes will have more money. They might spend it. At each stage, the sort of ripple gets smaller because of what we call withdrawals. Some of the money is saved. Some of the money is spent on imports going out of the economy. And some of it is taxed. So the ripple gets smaller. But there is a disproportionate impact of government spending. Now, what I was looking up is sort of estimates of the size of the multiplier. And there's a really good article on the Economics Observatory website.
Economics Observatory is brilliant.
But in normal times, so let's say you're not in a recession, then the fiscal multiplier is estimated to be pretty small, maybe even less than one. And the reason for that is obviously government expenditure needs to be financed. And that might lead to kind of things like crowding out.
Yeah, we should mention crowding out. It's a good thing to do, isn't it?
Yeah, so crowding out is a concept which is used to counter the idea that government should borrow money.
Yeah.
And the way I always explain this to kids in classes, let's imagine we've got a bucket in the room and it's filled with all the nation's savings. Now, savings aren't entirely, in a sort of open world economy, the only source of sort of borrowing, either for firms or for governments. But let's say the government, for wherever these sort of savings or sources of finance come from, the government is going in and sort of plundering that bucket. There is obviously then less available for the private sector, like firms, to borrow, to spend on investment, be it new technology, new factories and so on. You can imagine we've got this bucket full of sort of potential sort of investment funds which people can borrow. The government's like got its elbows out.
It's
elbowing the private sector firms out of the way. So during normal times, if you like, the argument is that the government borrowing too much money will crowd out the private sector. Also, if it's sort of normal times, if the government does expand the economy, well, there might be an offsetting response by the central bank. The central bank might be, okay, if the government's going to chuck loads of money at the economy, we're worried about inflation, we might raise interest rates.
Which is exactly what's happening now.
Expected. So in other words, the expansionary fiscal policy is met with the countervailing power of a contractionary monetary policy. So really good article, actually. We must tweet it, but on the Economics Observatory website about that. However, the fiscal multiplier can be quite high when you sort of head in sort of difficult times. If you've got what are called liquidity constrained consumers, like the people who might spend more if they're able to borrow, then that would increase the size of this multiplier. If the central bank, you know, the bank rate is already near zero, and again, the fiscal multiplier will have more of an impact. If the economy is sort of less open, you know, it's in a period where it's not as open to sort of world trade, or very simply, if the economy is in a recession. And at that point, the multiplier can be really quite big.
Yeah.
There's one estimate by Auerbach and Gorodnichenko in 2012 that it could be as high as 2 or 3 during a recession. Again, there's various studies about that, you know, how during a recessionary period or if labour markets are slack, you know, they're not tight, you know, there's unemployment, then the fiscal multiplier can really be quite powerful.
It is interesting, isn't it? Because there's always this chat about crowding out. But, I mean, we have mentioned this before. I mean, that's a concept called crowding in.
Mm.
You never really hear about that. But that is a great example of crowding in, because what the government is doing is bringing people with them. If I start spending, that means businesses might start spending as well, because they'll feel confident that the economy is going to be boosting a little bit more, so they might invest a little bit more, and so they start bringing people. So that kind of makes sense,
doesn't it? Yeah, and going back to the Osborne years, and if you make the comparison between the US and the UK, so it's obviously this awful financial crisis in 2008, which affected America and the UK really quite severely as sort of economies which have a sort of large financial sector, particularly the UK, but, you know, America as well. But the policy responses at that point were quite different. And the UK government quite quickly went for a kind of retrenchment, you know, a period of austerity. But if you're already in a sort of a downturn, then, you know, it maybe it doesn't make sense. You could have potentially, if you're in a recessionary period, got quite a lot of bang for your buck through an expansionary fiscal policy. And actually, the US took a lot longer before it engaged in retrenchment, perhaps when the economy had picked right back up. And, you know, there wasn't as much impact of an expansionary fiscal policy. But I suppose what I took from that is there's quite a bit of evidence that we went too soon for an austerity package.
Well, and Ed Balls suggested otherwise, didn't he?
Yeah, no, he did, yeah. He did, yeah.
But he wasn't really listened to, but there you go. Should we, I mean, is there much to say about Phillips? I mean, I suppose why we would mention Phillips there is just the fact that, I suppose, if you've got quite, I don't know, not much spare capacity within your economy, as with monetary policy, because it's a demand side policy, if you're boosting, you know, demand, you're going to come into problems in terms of the trade-off between inflation and unemployment, aren't you? So that's the reason why we mention that, in terms of the effectiveness of fiscal policy.
We've implicitly sort of mentioned that, have we, in that if there is a tight labour market, in other words, if unemployment is already quite low and you engage in an expansionary fiscal policy, the likelihood is inflation will rise.
Okay, cool. Are we done there, do you think?
Okay.
What does fiscal drag mean? And then are there any other policy peculiarities? I could say that word.
I'd like you to explain fiscal drag.
Ah, fiscal drag. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, this is where, if I get this correct, I hope I do, where basically as your income goes up, you get dragged into the different tax bands.
Yeah.
And so what's normally happened in the past, this is quite topical at the moment, isn't it? Because as basically people's incomes are rising, the government at the moment have frozen the tax bracket.
Yeah.
And so what it means is that a lot of people who thought they'd be kind of gaining from these big, you know, increases in income will not, because traditionally tax brackets have gone up by inflation. He's now decided they're not going to. So people get dragged into this higher bracket, which means they're paying more tax. Government should get more tax.
And actually,
and so that should fill the fiscal hole.
And actually, it's just because their nominal earnings have gone up rather than their real income because of inflation. And a similar threshold to things like where people can gain certain benefits. You know, if they're held the same, people's nominal income rises, and they'll be less entitled to certain sort of child benefits and so on.
Interesting. I mean, it's a quite a cheeky way of getting, because it's quite stealthy, isn't it?
You know, we're not putting up anything.
Exactly.
But because of
the
nominal increases, then people will be paying more
Exactly,
tax,
exactly. Any other policy peculiarities? Can you explain the poverty trap? This is sometimes, isn't it, where people can sort of have marginal tax rates of about 80%, can't they?
In terms of
being on benefits.
If you
and then you work an extra hour or 2 hours.
You'll lose certain benefits. It's a kind of cliff edge that you fall off. And actually, it's quite interesting because Milton Friedman, when we looked at Friedman, his negative income tax was a kind of way of trying to avoid sort of the poverty trap.
But it is a big problem because you do, I mean, literally, whenever you get someone on talking about obviously poverty and the number of hours worked, you'll always hear someone say, it's not worth me taking on an extra 2 hours because of X, Y, and Z. And so it is a massive issue that does need to be addressed. And the way to address it is not to basically make benefits worse, if that makes sense, because it's kind of tackling the wrong way. You need to have a better kind of transition. No, there seems through...
to be sort of, there needs to be this kind of cushioning, doesn't there, so that people are encouraged to work without initially losing sort of all their benefits. Because, you know, that would be irrational, wouldn't it?
Yeah. And one thing we should also mention here related to policy peculiarities is the Lafferka, because it's obviously in the news recently because of, again, Kwarteng's budget. This idea that you could probably say that a lot of it was based around the Lafferka, this idea that this kind of sense that if you lower income tax or corporation tax, even though it might seem kind of counterintuitive because you think, oh, you're not going to get as much tax in, because of incentives, you might actually increase your tax revenue because there'd be more firms setting up, more people paying tax, more people wanting to work because they can keep more of their money. Mm. And so this idea that you can lower taxes and increase government spending because you get more tax revenue. The only problem is that it's never really been proven to work as well.
I think it's interesting, before George Bush, when George Bush Sr. was going up against Reagan, he called it voodoo economics, I think. And certainly there's been some quite... I suppose the reason why, you know, how in theory could this work? So why could you gain more tax revenue by lowering taxes? As you said, it could incentivize people either to set up new businesses or work more hours. It could also lead to falls in tax avoidance and tax evasion, in theory. You could maybe get less of a brain drain as well. People might not move. Interestingly, I was reading quite an interesting study about, because obviously in America, you've got different taxes in different states, so in some respects it's almost a natural experiment to see, well, what are the impacts, do high wealth individuals move from state to state if the taxes are higher in one state than they are in the other. And the study I was reading, I must try and look it up, and but it sort of suggested it had far less impact than you might think, which in some respects is not surprising, because in some respects it's a bit like geographical immobility. People live in a particular place, their family live there, they're settled. Do they really move to another country? I mean, obviously you do get that, with some sports people moving to Monaco, but you used to always get this in the 80s, wouldn't you, like Labour get in, Phil Collins is going to move to so and so, and you're always thinking, well, go on then, you know.
Yeah,
it's never anyone that good, is it? You know, you think, oh, I'd be gutted if they...
Yeah, well, quite a few people did, didn't they? Stones and stuff like that. But it's interesting.
But the marginal rates of taxation at that point were way higher. Yeah, they were way higher.
But I'm glad that you pointed out that thing about who said voodoo economics first, because I read this article from Kate Andrews, who is an old IEA person now writing to The Spectator, and she said about kind of sort of talking about Truss and Kwarteng, saying about how she goes, oh, about how left-wing commentators had described, you know, this stuff as voodoo economics.
Mm.
And I was like reading it thinking, what, the famous left-wing commentator, George W. Bush?
No, you know, it's not W, it's his dad.
Oh, yeah. But it's like it's incredible to write that. You're like thinking... Anyway.
Yeah, it's very ill-informed, isn't it?
Right, okay, so that's the Laffer curve. Is there anything else? I suppose not.
I don't think so.
I mean, the thing, going back to the Laffer curve, obviously how that kind of links in with what is known as trickle-down economics. So that, again, you give people, rich people, money, it will trickle down through the economy, and that will create that kind of, you know, increase in demand in the economy generally.
Yeah. Right,
okay, let's move on. How does fiscal policy conflict with monetary policy, and how does it relate to supply-side policy?
Okay, that's quite a big question.
Yeah.
So
we've kind of mentioned some of it already.
Yeah, we have. Yeah, monetary policy in the UK operates in that we have an operationally independent Bank of England. So our central bank is given a target of achieving inflation of 2% plus or minus 1. So currently, inflation is way above that. So it's sort of October 2022 at about 10.1%. And this is largely, though, to be fair, due to cost push inflation. So a lot of import prices and energy costs have gone up dramatically due to the Ukraine conflict. That's had a significant impact on both energy and food prices. So because of that increase in inflation, the Bank of England has begun gradually to engage in a contractionary monetary policy. So very simply, increase in interest rates. The interesting part about that, I suppose, is that it's in a bit of a quandary in that the inflation is not really caused by, one could argue, excessive demand. Some people would say it is caused by excessive demand. So for some people, it's kind of an unwinding of the quantitative easing that's in part, or contributing, if you like, to the inflation. For most people, it's like, well, come on, it's cost prices. But for some people, they'd say, yeah, but there are some people with spare cash after sort of COVID, and you know, there's a lot of QE, and maybe that's beginning to sort of filter into the system and so on. But whatever way you look at it, if you do increase the bank rate, so the bank has recently increased its sort of central rate, that encourages people to save. It discourages consumption. And also indirectly, it does reduce some of those cost push pressures, because in theory, it should cause the pound to get stronger. With the reason for that being, if our interest rate is higher than other sort of countries around the world, then all of the things being equal, there should be a flow of funds into the UK economy, what we call hot money. Now, that's what should happen in theory, but people aren't going to buy pounds and UK products, even if, so UK financial products or government debt, even if the interest rate is high, if they feel that, you know, the UK economy is becoming a bit of a basket case.
Right.
And we'll come on to that in a minute. By the way, the Bank of England was planning on engaging in what we might call quantitative tightening.
Yeah.
So its plans were to sort of buy up government bonds. Instead of buying up government bonds, it used to as part of the QE process, it was hoping to sell assets from the bank's balance sheet and therefore reduce the money supply. And that would be part of its approach to bringing down these high rates of inflation. Quite a good FT article by Jagjit Chadhar about, you know, what the bank's plans were. This has all been sort of scuppered by the fiscal event, which caused a meltdown in the market for government gilts, so government, you know, bonds, if you like. The bank at that point felt it had to intervene in the gilt market. So rather than sort of selling bonds, it's had to buy them up again. And some people have said this is an example of what we call fiscal dominance. And this is where central banks use their monetary powers to support the price of government securities, in other words, gilts and so on. And they're trying to keep interest rates low in the economy, really to reduce the servicing costs of debt. And in simple terms, what that means is the Bank of England is in effect devoting itself to supporting the government's fiscal policies rather than sort of controlling inflation. In extremis, sort of fiscal dominance would be when the bank sort of prints, creates new money to support unfunded government spending. But I suppose in this particular case, it was like, well, we've got all this unfunded tax cuts coming through, the markets take fright, and then the Bank of England feels it has to step in. So rather than acting as the sort of guardian of you know, inflation reduction, it's then trying to protect the government's ability to borrow money on financial markets. So a bit of a mess.
Yeah. But I mean, it's always worth, isn't it, people thinking about that there are always sort of two sides of the coin, isn't there? So you always got to be thinking about the whole situation, fiscal policy and monetary policy, hopefully working in tandem.
Yeah.
And many are kind of arguing at the moment, it's like a push me, pull me, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it's always going to be a bit of that, you know, in some respects. I think you could say that during the, you know, the Osborne, well, no, maybe they worked in a complementary manner, but sort of Osborne's period of austerity, bank rate was really low.
Yeah.
And the idea is, oh, yeah, we are going to rein in government spending, but we're going to try and encourage consumption, investment through very sort of slack monetary policy, if you like.
Yeah, there's an interesting argument about why you don't want governments to have budget surpluses linked to that. Because if you've got a budget surplus, where is the deficit coming from? And it means it's coming from private people.
Yeah.
And so you just end up having lots of people in debt. Mm-hmm. And who's best to actually take on debt? Is it the government or is it us as the people? And so in actual fact, it's probably better to have the government in debt rather than us. Yeah. So it's kind of an interest, and you, that's definitely the case. I mean, you can see during Osborne's time is that, yes, he worried about, you know, the government's debts, but didn't care at all that we were just building up and building up this massive debt.
Private debt.
So it's kind of an interesting one to think about.
You did mention in the question as well, how can fiscal policy act as a supply side?
Yeah, I was wondering whether we should just not talk about that.
No. I think it's relevant. Right. So, because in a sense, fiscal policy can, if you sort of cut income tax, cut corporation tax, it can have, in theory, incentive effects.
Yeah.
It can encourage higher productivity.
But we should say probably what supply-side policies are.
Well, supply-side policy is anything which sort of... Well, something's laid out by the government to try and improve the... increase the capacity of the economy to produce. Often they're focused on productivity, trying to increase output per worker. They could, in a very broad sense, it doesn't just have to be sort of tax cuts. It could be like building
infrastructure,
new roads, infrastructure and things like that. That can increase the economy's capacity to produce. If you think about what Kwarteng and Truss felt they were doing, they felt they were engaging in fiscal policy as a supply side policy by cutting income tax, corporation tax and all of this. It will have massive incentive effects. There are quite a few people who would have agreed with their general direction of travel, but it's more this kind of,
timing,
yeah, ignoring the current context of high inflation and existing high debts meant that almost there are, people on the, conservative economists, neoclassical economists who would say, look, these might be the right policies, but the timing of it is not quite right. And they were advised as to that, I think.
And it's a classic, again, I don't want to, level too much A-level economist here, but like great kind of short run versus long run evaluative point to make, isn't it? Is that whenever you're discussing supply side policies, pretty much half the time, you're probably going to look at some short run aggregate demand effect before the long run aggregate supply effect comes in, and that's got to be managed well.
Yeah.
And it looked like at this moment in time
it
was going to have a big AD impact before any 2 or 3, maybe 8 years down the line, you'd get this kind of supply side effect coming in.
Yeah, and
so you've kind always got that balance to
play. So in a sense, they're thinking, oh, we're creating Singapore on Thames, this kind of low tax culture, which is going to encourage investment. But if you are in a situation where inflation's already sort of double digit in your effect, as you say, the short run impact would be to pump more demand into the economy, then everyone's like, what?
Yeah, crazy stuff. Yeah. Crazy. Should we end it there?
Yeah.
Okay, here we go. Last question. What books would we recommend and why?
Well, over to you here, because I know you've got a few recommendations.
Okay. Well, the thing is, we got to point out that a lot of the time, we do like the same books.
We do recommend
and
the same books.
And they do kind of cross over. So, again, we've talked about Duncan Weldon's
200 Years of Muddling Through. Excellent book. Brilliant. Yeah, strongly recommend.
You mentioned, I think, with the monetary policy one, the deficit myth one. It's an interesting one, isn't it? Stephanie Kelton's book about whether you would argue it's fiscal or monetary policy. Even though it's kind of like modern monetary theory, it sort of does relate to fiscal.
It definitely does.
Yeah, management. But kind of a couple of new ones. I mean, The Undercover Economist Strikes Back by Tim Hartford is always a really good book on macroeconomics.
David Smith, even?
No. Undercover Economist Strikes Back, that's Tim Hartford.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
I thought he was The Undercover Economist then. I thought that was David Smith.
No, it's Tim. And then we have got a David Smith book coming up here.
Oh, maybe that's
why. Which was recommended by your wife, which is called Something Will Turn Up. She says it's a brilliant book related to fiscal policy.
Yeah.
So we recommend that on her behalf. Oh. And also, last time we talked about Howard Davis, The Chancellor's Tales book.
Right, yeah.
And he got in contact with us.
Did he?
Yeah. And said, it's not that book anymore. or there is that book out there, but he's got an updated book called The Chancellor's Steering the British Economy in Crisis Times.
That sounds fascinating.
And I would assume that is a book to read related to fiscal policy.
Yeah, good.
Okay.
Yeah, excellent.
Jolly good. Now, you know what time it is, Pete?
What time is it?
Poetry time.
Oh, you've got poem.
You can't escape it. You can't escape it.
Whew. Okay.
Are you ready for it?
Big intake of breath, yeah.
It's called A Fiscal Policy Poem.
Right. Well, it does what it says on the tin.
Yeah, exactly.
Is it ready? Short?
No. Oh. You wish to learn about fiscal policy, I see. Well, let me help you. I have a degree. It's all decided that the Treasury, under the jurisdiction of His Majesty, a good way to remember is G&T. The G stands for government and how they spend your money on things like police stations, hospitals and universities, building infrastructure and libraries, development aid to poor countries, benefits to the less well-off and OAPs, as well as supporting us through emergencies. The T stands for tax, which they get from your salary, or when you buy something with VAT, or from the profits of a company, or when you fill your SUV, or drink a bottle of Chablis, or import stuff from overseas, or when a loved one falls on their knees. It can help with government objectives like inequality or dealing with different externalities, and of course helping with the economy. But don't ever think that people will agree. So that's it really. That's the policy. Now you can be the next Zahawi, Rishi, Quasi, I mean Hunt, or whoever it might be.
Oh, God. Phew.
It's painful. It was painful. But we got through it, Pete.
Yeah, we got through it. Yeah.
We'd like to thank everybody for listening to our fiscal policy special. And we'd like to thank Nick, as always, for all his help with regards podcasts. Please get in contact with us via Twitter and Instagram and email.
Yeah, email.
economicsintent@gmail.com.
Yeah.
It's that time of the year as well that you might be thinking about sending Christmas cards. Yeah. So if you want us to send us a few of our economics Christmas cards, we can get them in the post for you. Just drop us an email.
Yeah, we'd love to do that. So, hope you enjoyed that, everybody.
Hope you learned a lot. Thank you very much.
Good evening.